Hello and welcome to Raising Anchor, your podcast and source for all things Rhode Island FC. I'm your host, Matt Intrigan, coming to you on this Thursday, November 13th, 2025. Rhode Island FC returns to the Eastern Conference Final for their second year in a row after laying to rest North Carolina FC 2-0 in their path to the USL Cup Final. We're going to talk about the wake now, the celebration of a club no longer there. Before then, we talk about whether or not they can reclaim the mantle of heading all the way to the final show of the season, taking on the Pittsburgh Riverhounds here this weekend. The action is going to be at Highmark Stadium, and it's been a place that we have seen some success. When you look at the broader spectrum, it's a place that's been very hostile to Rhode Island. And to join me and see if he still believes is the one and only co-host, Mr. Jason Carey. Jason, how are you doing, my friend?
Doing great. About two more sleeps till the trip to Pittsburgh. Second Eastern Conference final in a row. Can't complain.
Why would you? But as always in these playoff editions, it's time to outdo you and bring in the big guns, because when it's playoff time, we got to get the experts. And we went out, we scoured the globe for the one and only. You might know him from some of his films, but the one and only John Krasinski. The privilege is all ours, John. You come from such an esteemed background, Pittsburgh Soccer Now as an editor, and of course, the Sounding Off on Soccer podcast. Welcome to the show for the first time, and we are so glad to have you here in this playoff edition.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm a big fan. I enjoy everything that comes over from Blazing Musket and your work especially. I try to keep informed and certainly appreciate all that you guys do.
You know, I want to start things off maybe a little hostile. Maybe it's the appropriate setting here for this playoff match. But I was reading the article, the preview of Rhode Island FC today. I know you didn't write it, but it seems like there's some confusion about what we call Rhode Island as a nickname. I saw called the Anchormen. We got called the Lobstermen in there.
That's our good rabbi, soccer rabbi, Mark Goodman. He certainly has a way with words and loves to get into the banter and talk about the teams and kind of, you know, what identifies the teams when he's doing his previews and some of his takes. Wonderful writer, great guy. And I did get, obviously, read this. It's my website. So, the Anchorman. Yeah, I did see that. I didn't know if we would see... you know, Will Ferrell and Steve Carell and those guys coming out. But no, I don't think you guys are true Rhode Islanders. I don't know. I think he was just having some fun with it.
No, I wonder if Steve Carell actually has ownership in a team. We know Will Ferrell owns LAFC, so we have to see with the rest of them. So the naming, and the fans can either agree or disagree, but it goes by two naming conventions. The fan naming convention is the Tide, which came up organically, and then there is kind of more what USL and the club have tried to, I don't say push because that's not fair, but then there's the Anchors. So we go by the two of them. Most often you'll see the Tide as the reference. So for future articles, when we talk about whatever the result will be this weekend, let the rabbi know the update there. But hey, listen,
I love it's a Tide. I remember the Tidewater Tides back in the day.
That's part of it. Exactly. You get it. So, let's get through this news pretty quick here, because we've got a lot to talk about in this preview. Real quickly, on the Rhode Island FC side of things, Centerville Bank Stadium has announced that they're going to be opening up for a viewing party for this Eastern Conference final. Has not yet been done in the regular season. Jason, I think you went to a watch party as they were testing some of the mechanics for a Messi Argentina friendly earlier in the season.
Yeah, that was also like on a random Wednesday in June for the Club World Cup. I honestly think it was like Juneteenth, and I think it was one of those things where not everyone had it off. There was a, I guess you could say, decent turnout for a random day of the week. I'm curious to see what this will look like. I think there's a lot more gravitas to this as opposed to just like, oh, look at Messi play I don't even remember who it was. I think it was a Portuguese team.
We've heard that there is a very large enrollment in, because you do need to have a ticket for the event to get into the stadium. We've heard that both the normal watch party at the Guild, it still seems to be kind of intact, and then this split to Centerville Bank Stadium. From what we've been told, there's going to be a merch sale. There's going to be several concession stands open. The clubhouse will be open, so you'll be able to kind of be indoors from that chilly sub 40 mid 30s weather that's going to be, you got to love New England in like the fall going into the winter time for playoff soccer. I don't know if there'll be discounted concessions. I don't know if the pretzel stand will be open for business. I hope they are. But then the kids will have access to the field to kind of burn some energy. So whether you go to the Guild or you go to Centerville Bank Stadium or you go to Pittsburgh this weekend, what matters is you go and hang out with all of the Forever Faithful and enjoy this wonderful game. But speaking of Pittsburgh and those that are going there, a bit of controversy this week, or maybe not so much so, as Rhode Island's Forever Faithful took to the social media to complain about ticket allocations. John, I want to ask you, I don't know if you've been following the hubbubaloo between the fan bases. Devin Kerr, I think tongue in cheek, I didn't agree with his statement on USL All Access this week. He said, if fans want to complain, then have your team win, you know, get into the home berth seat so you can host a game. I thought that wasn't fair to the fans because it's not like they have control over the performance on the pitch. But what have you been hearing about it? Is there anything you have from an insider perspective on the Pittsburgh side of thing as far as these ticket allocations? And has this ever been a problem for traveling fans before?
I would say no, it hasn't been a problem that I can remember. Now, I've been covering this team for a long time, and all the way through the Highmark Stadium era, which started in 2013. I do remember a couple instances, DC United coming here in 2015, and the Hounds sort of limiting that to a section. But there was a section for them. I remember that. And can't think of too much else. I don't think Columbus traveled very well for their game here a few years ago. But, yeah, other than that, I mean, Cincinnati, when they were in USL, of course, but the Hounds weren't anywhere near selling out the way they are now. So, yeah, I haven't heard too much in terms of it's just pretty much been first come, first serve. I know there's been a huge push because, look, they both playoff matches, they started almost from ground zero in terms of ticket sales. Like, I don't know how exactly it worked in with this. I'm sure the season ticket holders had first preference. I know that. But they were starting from ground zero, and they had the first match. They were 67 seats short of a true sellout. The Hartford match, I think it was 4,000. It was just under 5,000, which is a sellout. Now, with overflow, standing room, that type of thing, they've gotten as high as they did last Saturday, which is 6,220, I think was the official number. So that's somewhere in that ballpark. There may have been a few other non-Riverhounds events at Highmark that went over that. I think it was a concert. I think that had like 8,000 or 9,000, but that's a different circumstance because you can use the field. But yeah, so I would say it's been pretty much first come, first serve. I don't know anything else beyond that in terms of how they, and I should have asked. I was down at the practice training facility today. I could have asked the media relations about that, it's pretty much what it's been. And they were just hoping anybody, you know, tickets would get gobbled up. So last week was great. This week it looks like it's going to be, you know, it's going to be that around that number, maybe even higher.
Hopefully they'll park all of those riverboats right in front of the stadium and get an extra couple thousand to be able to watch the game. From what I've heard from both camps, the whole ticket allocation thing isn't what the public has been made to believe. There's some other stories that go on behind the scenes of how that allocation works. You know, unfortunately, it's just fan opinion gets ahead of it. And so I'll kind of leave it at that. USL, I think, does need to do a better job of making a transparent league policy that a certain amount of tickets or a certain section at any given stadium, regardless of attendance in either the home section or traveling fans, there's a little bit more clarity because the league rules are always so obscure. But Jason, I want to ask you just to kind of circle back to the whole thing. Is it fair that Devin Kerr said if Rhode Island FC fans want to complain, just win a home seed berth?
I mean, it kind of is what it is. I think, unfortunately, you know, I mean, I think the one thing he did bring up though about the stadium, I think is fair. They have basically half the capacity of Centerville Bank Stadium. So, you know, especially with the turnout that they've had recently, obviously, it's a hot ticket in town. So, it, you know, I think this is a very specific circumstance that probably wouldn't happen in most other stadiums.
Especially if Detroit had won last week and then it would have ran through Centerville Bank Stadium. But that is not the case, as this will be determined in Pittsburgh on the weekend. And then, of course, no matter which team comes out of it, they will be then traveling to either Albuquerque or Tulsa to taste glory. I'm going to pivot really quickly because two other pieces of news dropped today. So I just want to get initial reactions. First team and second team, all USL championship was announced today. You know, media votes on this. This is not a fan vote. And John, I don't know if you get a vote in this, but I'm putting the first team up. The one and only Sean Suber ends up on the first team. Is this not well deserved? And or was this a surprise to see him make it to first team?
Yeah, actually, it's the first year. I don't think first year I didn't have a vote. So because I was out last year, I missed a lot of actually just being there in person. So because my wife had battled cancer, she's has overcome it and she's doing really, really well now. But a lot of last season I missed, so I kind of got off at the beginning of this season. I was kind of out of the mix in the beginning, doing on-site reporting. So Keith Barnes from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette had the Pittsburgh area vote. Sean Suber, just the durability, the fact that he put in the labor. I don't think he missed a single minute in league play. His second year with the Hounds, his second year in this system, and towards the end he had a couple big goals. If you just look at the defensive metrics, actually Guillaume Vactor, the UConn guy, I mean, he was amazing for the Hounds this year. I think it came in a little bit past the beginning of the season. They signed him a little bit after the season started officially. I think him back there, Beto Yedrich, that trio in the back line has been tremendous. They're Suber and Yedrich I definitely like to get forward a little bit more. They like to have the ball at their feet a little bit more. Vactor's been more just the cold-blooded defensive, just, he'll just shut you down, shut everybody down, and winning those one-on-one battles, tackles, whatnot. But no, Suber, it is earned. It is deserved. I think he caught the attention. I think he's got a gazillion clearances. I think his clearances are way, way, way up there among the league leaders. So some of those numbers kind of jumped out to some of the voters, and Sean is he's a really impressive guy. I think he's very he's got those leadership skills too. I think that I think other coaches and I think people around the league have taken notice, and I think he's definitely, when you're the center back of a Pittsburgh Riverhounds team that has been once again one of the top defensive units in the league, and Eric Dick wasn't quite, he was at a great season, don't get me wrong, but he wasn't on his gold glove pace of last year. I think that's kind of where Suber gets the nod, gets the one Riverhound player who got on the 11.
I can't help but notice that there's only two players remaining in active hunt for the USL Cup final on this first team, very heavy with Charleston and Lou players as they ran away with the league. And yet none of them are still playing at this moment in time. Jason, flipping it over to you with the second team. Again, no Rhode Island FC player in the mix here. And why is that a problem that we didn't see Koke Vegas as the second team all-league goalkeeper over Danny Vitiello?
I really think he should have got the nod. Especially with how close he was to actually winning the Golden Glove. To be fair to Vitiello, he is a very great keeper. But we're still in the playoffs and they are not. I think these votes were probably cast a little bit earlier. And I think, unfortunately, they probably took into consideration that Koke did miss half the season.
And that's what I think it is. When you go and look actually at the performances on the season, Koke Vegas had a better goals allowed per minute right behind Damian Loss. He had the fewest goals conceded, again, right behind Damian Loss. And he had the most clean sheets in the league, tied with Danny Vitiello. I think it really comes down to the fact that Vitiello had 20 additional saves because he played those 10 extra games. And so while his saves per minute average, or his goals against, per minute average per 90 was worse, it's because of that extra 10 game span. I still think that if you go by the numbers and you don't have any kind of cutoff or threshold, it should have been Koke Vegas. We heard last week John Morrissey said that it should have been Koke Vegas. So I think there's been a robbery here. And now Koke's got to do the right thing and just win the whole thing at this point. You know, he doesn't need second team when he can go out as a champ. Quickly moving through, want to ask the other thing that dropped today, gentlemen. MLS schedule is changing. I don't want to talk about the MLS because this is hashtag not an MLS podcast, but I do want to ask about what we think the immediate impact that this will have on the USL structure when this takes place in 2027. How do we feel about that? Do we see an opportunity here? We've heard what's not on the screen, if you're following along on the live stream, is the calendar now starting in July and then ending in that May window with the summer off. They will be doing a Mickey Mouse Cup in the first couple of months of 2027 to rotate that system in so that they still have playing time for the players before they reset the window. How does USL take advantage of this now? Like, do they need to put the best games, the best competitions, and the most marketing right in that summer window? How does USL take advantage? John, we'll start with you.
Well, I think USL, it was about 2020 or 2021, it got tossed around, this very same idea, and then they kind of gave up on it. I think they're very happy with where they are. I think that will continue. Now, as far as this goes, I think it's just you showcase the league when you can. You've got some really good TV contracts and broadcast contracts, broadcast outlets that are giving the league some good exposure. You know, you're in with ESPN or with CBS or whatever it becomes into 27, 28, 20 down the road. So your summer programming, you get that exposure there. I think that's, you do what you can. I think you just stay the course. I think MLS is not even as concerned maybe about attendance. And so I think from an attendance standpoint, because I mean, you can't, if MLS made attendance their priority, they wouldn't be playing, I don't know, maybe it'll be 7, 8, 9 games in December and January and early February, you know, or something like that for each team. But we're talking northern cities are going to have to play at least 3 or 4 games, you know, at home during that stretch, maybe 3 games, too. I mean, it's all about the money. It's all about the broadcast, the deals. It's all about the transfer window in the summer. You know, that's where MLS wants that to hit that sweet spot. And I think they want to be in line with all the major, you know, the leagues overseas. And, you know, that's their, you know, that's up to them. That's their prerogative. But I just think that USL should just stay the course, do their thing. And you know, they'll soccer, you know, look, one thing about this country, or even here, like I manage a website for Pittsburgh Soccer. I mean, I would say maybe January, it's slow, but that's about it. You know, maybe January, a little bit of February.
Yeah, I agree with John there. The one thing I'm really curious to see is it seems like they're doing this specifically to line up with the transfer windows.
Yeah, that's right. The intent.
So yeah, is that going to actually pay dividends for them? Are there teams out there who actually want MLS talent but are like, and the timing isn't right, so I'm going to go shop elsewhere? So all of a sudden, are we going to see summer transfer windows where millions of dollars are going to be pumped into the MLS system to buy our players? I don't know if that's the case. I think MLS really overrates and values how good they actually are. We see on a consistent basis, they still get whomped by Liga MX teams.
But they're ranked 9th in terms of all leagues across the international window.
Like, that is
USL by comparison in Division 2 is like 65th.
I don't buy that.
Well, fine, that's fine. But like,
I mean, we see our, like, legit, we see our teams get smashed by Liga MX teams. We see if like these foreign teams would actually come over here and play their full squads, they would swipe us away. We are not the 9th league, maybe in terms of valuations of money, because we're overinflated. But I don't think the talent is there. That they've definitely gotten better over the years I've been watching.
So they're taking a gamble on the product being superior, which will keep the eyes on it, allow them to compete and make more money. Whereas USL here, then, what I'm hearing is they have the advantage. to find a window in time where the only thing you're competing with then is baseball. And let's be honest, at that particular quarter, you're almost at all-star break, and almost every fan of that sport will tell you, you know whether your team's making playoffs by the all-star game. So that's when you see attendance start to kind of drop off, and they're really just going to do, you know, to do an event for the summer, to get out for the weekend. So I think USL is primed to capitalize on this. And then especially with the storylines of Division One and Pro Rail coming, I really think that they got to market this, and they got to look at the schedule, and they got to find all the rivalry. You know, like, credit to MLS, they have a rivalry week. I think they have two of them. They kind of are sandwiched in like the first quarter and then the tail quarter. They try to do it as much as possible to build those up. You never really have that sense of like, this is an important week to pay attention to the USL. You'll have games like, oh yeah, this is this derby, this is that derby. It might benefit them to go, hey, all eyes on this week. USL is dominating the charts. We want you watching all of these. All these are all teams that hate each other, and you need to tune in.
But it could feel like manufactured in that point. And then also at the same time, how many people are going to watch multiple games, right? If there is a big rivalry or something to highlight, absolutely. Say, this is El Clamico. Check it out. It's prime time. But to also say, also, we've got, you know, the you know, reinvigorated Southern Harm Derby or something.
Listen,
somehow that comes up.
Maybe I'm like the oddball, but I will tell you, the only time I actively pay attention to teams outside of the ones I like to watch in MLS is in those weeks, because I know those are the big lineups. So maybe I'm the outlier, maybe I'm the normal one, and you have to go and do some soul searching. I don't know.
I couldn't even tell you when those weeks are.
But we have to move on and go and find out more about. We got to move on to this recap here against North Carolina and quickly burn through that so we can get to the preview. Listen, Rhode Island FC is the second team ever in the USL Championship era to advance to the conference final in both of its first two seasons. The only other team that has done that, according to what I found, is the Tampa Bay Rowdies. And it's almost not even fair to compare the Rowdies to Rhode Island FC, because as you can so see in their badges here, they're celebrating 50 years. So as an organization, they've been there the entire time. They just were going through a new league as they had moved from NASL into that new window. So it's almost convenient that we talk about the fact that this team is doing something that really has never been done before in the history of USL. Again, a foundation has been built here. Kano is putting together legacy at this point. We were all so questionable about his abilities to get this team to where it needed to be. And now look, here we are, kind of basically one step from where we last left off. And we talked about the scars. We talked about how much this team is ready to learn from the lessons, not just in the regular season, but also the postseason of last year. Most of this team is the same team. Honestly, Morris Dugan is the only player that would not be starting in a final tomorrow based on the rotation of, I mean, Amos Shapiro Thompson's probably cemented himself as a starter as well, but these players all exist, right? So Jason, I'm going to ask, what does it say about this team finding form right now, finding this foundational excellence that Kano has built? What does this say about, so, and it's so early in club history, how do we go back in time, like go forward 10 years and look back? What are we going to say about this time?
It kind of feels like this team is cementing their legacy, maybe their DNA, if you will. You know, like you look at certain teams and they evoke certain, you know, like ideas, certain thoughts, right? At this point, we could start to, you would look at RAFC, it's like, okay, they're definitely a late season team, someone who's going to show up late and, you know, really push into the playoffs. And kind of make a run at the right time. They're very like resilient, tough team. They're difficult to break down. You know, they're not maybe always going to score a lot, but they're not going to make it easy for you to score. And they're going to kind of really continue to fight there till the end.
Agreed. So let's talk about how this team really had this breakout moment against North Carolina. We talked at length at the Charleston game, understanding that, you know, it was a 0-0, goes to pens, the resiliency, also though, just the domination in a lot of ways, not quite the same in this North Carolina game. I felt like we continued to play our style, but North Carolina was a bit more reactive to it than maybe Charleston tried to impose their will, and it was a clash. I felt more like with North Carolina, It was John Bradford's team bending and trying to find alternate ways, sometimes looking dangerous, sometimes not. I mean, from a lineup configuration standpoint, the formation was basically the same, albeit one change there.
Yeah, and so when we look at how RAFC lined up for this game, Koke Vegas in net with a back three of Frank Nodarse, Karifa Yao, and Hamani Diop. We've got Amos Shapiro-Thompson, Clay Holstead, Ugo Bacharach, and Aldair Sanchez making up that midfield, with Aldair being the one change there because Quisera's out on that red. Front three of Noah Fusson, J.J. Williams, and Zach Haravo there. And like you said, you know, Bradford did really kind of, and NCFC to their credit, I think that they kind of went for it there in the first half. But second half, RAFC really kind of took control of the
RAFC game is a second half team. Whether you like it or not, the sparks will fly. Talking about the game overall, we were there. We kind of touched on the mailbag. So if you want some more fun answers, go listen back to the Monday show. But 2,300 fans show up. Is this the send-off that North Carolina deserved?
I don't think so. I think it's really unfortunate a way to kind of bury a team. But I also, at the same time, maybe that's kind of a sign of the times. And the reality is maybe the writing was there on the wall. You know, every time we would watch the team, or you go back and look at any of their highlights, doesn't look like there's anyone there in that stadium. So, and you know, I've heard that they don't own that stadium either. So in that regards, not having control over that revenue stream really makes it difficult for a team to thrive, especially if you're not bringing in like, what, 7,000 to 9,000 like the women's team is. So it's unfortunate. You know, I kind of was hoping for a little bit better of a send off from them. At the end of the day, we were able to kind of, you know, get by and go forward. So it's good for us, but maybe not so much for them.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, you think about it too, North Carolina, if they had won that game, the Eastern Conference final would have ran through them, right? And instead they struggle, they can't get the job done. And now Pittsburgh, given a lifeline when you think about it. And we're going to try to see if John's having massive audio problems right now. So we're going to see if we can get John back in here. And, you know, brace your ears for those listening along, because every time I've tried to add him back, it's pretty wild. Let's see if John, are you back? All right, let's see. He is. I can't unmute him. So let's see if he wants to. He's definitely trying to come back in. I respect it. Let's see if he can get this back on. It's like an office meeting, Jason. You're double muted, and it happens to the best of us. Let's see. John, I still can't hear you, bud. All right, John, I'm going to give you the classic IT instructions I would give anyone. Why don't you have a restart and then come back in, and we'll add you here in a second. We'll get back to that question for you. So, John, I'll be right back, and then in the meantime, we're going to keep talking here about what's going on. And, like, listen, the two big talking points for me, I think, were, one, Chico. Got to acknowledge this. We thought this game was going to run through J.J. Williams. We saw what that would look like last year with all of the excellence he had in his postseason. You come back through this time around, and, you know, he's been a force. He's been a physical force on the front line, but two goals come through the great Chicolio. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, really great to see him get a brace there. I mean, it's, you know, his fifth career multi-goal game there across all competitions. He's actually now tied for leading scorer in the playoffs, which is kind of funny. I mean,
wild.
It's been a low scoring playoffs. You know, I love the celebration. He keeps, you know, pulling out that. So that's fun.
It's, you know, that not only though is he tied with J.J. Williams, he's also tied for leading goal scorer in the playoffs for 2022 for 2025 as well.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Like he's
tied. Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about J.J. Williams and that tie as well.
Yeah, no. The fact that he's tied for the leading playoff score is kind of wild in the sense that, you know, after this many rounds, you see how many goals have actually been scored. And
did he win the Jägermeister Cup as well with the Hattie against Hearts of Pine?
He might have been up there.
How funny. We did, like, we've been so maligned against this guy, so dismissive, and he may go on to have some of the highest goal scoring across cup competitions in the entirety. He may not, because as the final progressed, maybe someone took him out, but like, how ironic that we've been so low on Chico.
I mean, it's crazy that this. Chico has 3 playoff goals. They've all been with RAFC. So he didn't actually get a chance with Pittsburgh. The player shield season, they got knocked out first round. He wasn't actually able to score. So for as prolific as he has been at times during the regular season, he's only got 3 goals in his playoff career.
We're going to see what John has to say about Chico if he's back. John, are you back?
Yeah, I'm back. Sorry about
that. There we go.
Yeah, just a quick note. You know, we obviously saw Chico when he came up as a 20, 21-year-old. His first year in Pittsburgh, he came in the COVID year, and he had some visa, you know, a lot of issues, people had those issues. He had some visa issues, so he didn't get here until about halfway through the season. And I knew Bob Lilly had really liked him. He started to kind of come on a little bit towards the end of that season. And he did start the playoff game at Louisville. So he's had some playoff experience, you know, there, and then of course, you know, through the years. But no, that match in the Detroit match in 23, even after a spectacular season, of course, he was the it got a lot of attention from Detroit that day, as well. He certainly earned that. I think the Hounds didn't have any other answers, in terms of the final third that night. But yeah, he's had some. I mean, he's had some experience, if there was, but he, like you said, never scored a goal. That was just the one knock on him in terms of his experience in Pittsburgh in the postseason.
So I have this note from Chico, about him. He is actually now the all-time leading scorer as a sub as well, with 6 goals off the bench in both seasons. And what's even crazier, he's the second player in club history to score multiple goals from the bench. I thought we would have had a higher number from that by now, but that looks like that wasn't a thing. He's also set a single game club record with a goal every 7.5 minutes. So like, this is a guy who, again, has cemented himself in Rhode Island FC club history, but he's also already done the same thing down in his time with Pittsburgh and the Riverhounds. I think Seth Macomber said it best on the Blazing Musket. This is why you buy a player like Chico. We know we have another year with him. Should all the people that say, oh, let's move on from him, do they need to kind of quiet down now, Jason, because Chico's the real deal?
I mean, I think at this point he's got a certain return of investment on him, if you will, right? He's got us into the Eastern Conference Final here. We've got some good performances from him in the Jägermeister Cup as well, too. I think the problem that he has, why people are critical, is he's very streaky. In a sense of, he can go numerous games without scoring goals, and just kind of all of a sudden he'll just drop a hat trick out of nowhere.
So. Just because he can. Hey, for time, I want to talk about one more thing, and that is Noah Fusson and Hamdi Diop kind of at the same time. There were lots of other players that deserved some attention on this game. Definitely you could argue Koke Vegas keeping the team in it with some critical saves. JJ Williams and his production rate, but I want to quickly bring up Noah Fusson. Once he reclaims the playmaker for Rhode Island with that assist in the playoff match there against North Carolina, and now up to 4 across all competitions in the championship. Again, we've talked about the offensive woes of this team this year. To know that it's only 4 is what is the top setter now, right now. But Noah does reclaim his mantle as playmaker for Rhode Island FC. And then you found some interesting things out about Hamdi Diop, who we've been very, very high on. He has been very comfortable into his transition here from San Diego FC, but he's really starting to shine brightly, kind of almost a Morris Dugan-esque performance in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, it does really feel like he kind of came out of nowhere. We didn't know how big of a deal he would be, and all of a sudden he is, you know, vital to this back line. He attempted 80 passes in this game. It's the first time in the season that a Rhode Island player has actually attempted that many in a single USL championship match. And it's more so than, you know, like Tristan Hodge had the most on the other side. There were only 49. But on top of that, 91% pass accuracy, 101 touches. Kind of feels like some of the ball runs through him, if you will, in the back there.
And we're going to talk about that at length in this preview of Pittsburgh now, because if you think about it, there has to be trust in this back line. There's going to be so much contesting in the midfield that when you have the likes of Yao, you have the likes of Jope, and you have, let's say it's Nodarse for the time being, but it's so interchangeable on that right side. You have to have these players have the permission to move up and down the pitch as needed, but then the confidence that they're going to be there and really cement the positioning for this side. I think Jope, and for all of his time that he's been here, it's like you kind of wish, like, man, if only we had him at the beginning of the season, what could have been, right? Maybe this playoff game would be running through Centerville Bank Stadium instead of Highmark. But now is the time, and I want to start things off, John. I want to pull up a bracket and just kind of quickly go over it. Did we expect this to be where it was? If you had done there was no surviving playoff bracket per USL after, I think, the Detroit Cup set, but did you have this as Rhode Island and Pittsburgh on the east, and did you have Tulsa, New Mexico on the west as we were kind of getting down to the USL Cup final here pretty soon?
Well, on the west, I would say I certainly have always had New Mexico on my radar. Dennis Sanchez and, of course, Valentin Noel, both of them came over from Vegas, and I just always had my eye on that group. And Valentin, of course, is a friend of my podcast and is a former Pitt player. Is just one of those difference makers in this league, and we're seeing it in this third, I think it's his second or third year. Tulsa just keeps finding ways. You know, it reminds me, a couple of years ago, the Riverhounds played a little bit different Tulsa team, but still the same thing in an Open Cup match. Actually, it was last 2024, and they just found a way, got a goal like in the 88th minute in a 0-0 game in an Open Cup match. And, you know, like that's kind of like emblematic of a Tulsa team that we've seen a lot of this year. They're just gritty. They find ways to win. And those are the teams that, you know, just keep plugging along. But on the Eastern Conference side, nobody envisioned this. I think Louisville and Charleston were just so strong. And look at the Riverhounds, kind of lucked out in a lot of ways, but their record for all season, except for the win at Hartford, that, you know, the one that stirred up quite a bit of controversy, that was probably their you know, best quality win. They didn't beat Louisville. They tied Louisville. They lost Louisville. I believe they lost both matches to Charleston. They lost to North Carolina and drew North Carolina, and they even lost and drew to Loudoun. So the top four teams that were in front of them most of the season, but they were able to get ahead of Loudoun and Hartford. They really didn't beat anybody, you know, in front of them all season. And so the fact that, you know, they got the four seed in itself was fortunate. They did play well down the stretch enough, and defensively they were always in every game. So, you know, the only thing I could add to that is that, and you know, the Rhode Island, Detroit, and Pittsburgh, all three just make life difficult for anyone, including the Charlestons and the Louisville City. So, you know, been around this game long enough that I know that, you know, at this level, it can happen, but no, I didn't. If you had asked me, I would have. I was picking Louisville and Charleston at least to get for a rematch.
Jason, how about you? Anything stand out? I will say I don't like that we continue to be called the cup set. We cup set Charleston, then we cup set North Carolina because of the seating position. Obviously, we knew Rhode Island was going to be here because we've been forever faithful. We believe. I think we were pretty solid on the West. Were you surprised Pittsburgh made it as far as they did?
To a certain extent, I always, you know, think of Pittsburgh as an incredibly difficult team to beat, but I kind of expected them to run into Louisville, and Louisville would just do what Louisville does and get by them. The fact that Detroit then got past them, I thought it's like, well, maybe Detroit's getting hot at the right time. I just, you know, when it comes to Pittsburgh, I don't associate scoring a lot with them in regards to like them just being, you know, incredibly difficult to play against. And, you know, Detroit somewhat similar, but always felt that they had an extra goal or two in them. But maybe it's just the right time for them that just kind of things kind of started to click.
I mean, when you look at it here now on the screen, you've also got the who do you pick to advance to the conference final. The disrespect for Pittsburgh and Rhode Island FC, 8% believed they would make it, 4% of the USL community thought Rhode Island would make it. And then weirdly, all the way to advance to the final now. And I'm not sure if these are carryover numbers, but then suddenly it switches and 6% of Rhode Island or 6% of the community thinks Rhode Island FC possibly could have gone on to the USL Cup final with just 5% for Pittsburgh. But you look at these Tulsa numbers, 66%, 35%, 39% for New Mexico, 21%. No matter what happens, the East needs to win this USL Cup, guys. Like, we have lost it, what, I think 5 years in a row now, even though we've normally been the more dominant teams, the more high-profiled organizations out here in the Eastern Conference, can't get it across the finish line in that USL Cup. So no matter what happens next, John, whether it's the 5% Pittsburgh or the 6% Rhode Island, one of these teams has to go on and win the whole thing.
Hey, I mean, again, they'll make life difficult for whoever they play. We know that. So, yeah, I think that's one thing. Do we want the most beautiful, it will be the most beautiful soccer we'll see with either one of them getting through and then winning the whole thing? You know, that remains to be said. But I will say, I think the Riverhounds have played well. I know they haven't scored. There's a little bit more freedom to express with Rob Vincent, you know, at the helm coaching. I think there's some tweaks. I'm not as one of those people who I would say it's a complete change, and they're just, I mean, because they still are playing by the principles of Lily Ball, and they, even with Bob Lilly not being there, not being physically present, his fingerprints, his blueprint is all over this team in terms of their discipline, their defensive, you know, how well they are structured, the way they build their defensive block. And I think it's just a little bit, just watching those wingers take some chances, maybe a little bit more, Danny Griffin kind of in the middle has a little bit more freedom to express. So I think there's some of that. And of course, you know, they did some subs. They only used two subs last week, which was interesting because way back and when the Riverhounds had Louisville knocked out in 2019. I mean, they were up 1-0. They had about four or five unbelievable chances. They couldn't convert. That was, to me, the turning point of the, you know, maybe they wouldn't have had all this bad luck in the Highmark Stadium era in terms of postseason. They couldn't put Louisville away, and you can't put a team like that away. They came back and bit them and won that match. But my point is that this is a, you know, a team that is playing on the front foot. They're having problems in the final third with whether it's, you know, it's Augie Williams at the top, you know, the target forward. I think he struggled a little bit. I think Danny Griffin had a point blank chance. Robbie Mertz has been creative. A chance creation is good. But, you know, we'll see. I just think that it's not just going to be, it's a heavyweight bout. I think when you look at Rhode Island versus Pittsburgh, and that's how that last match they played, that 2-0 game in Pittsburgh was. And then, you know, the Hounds kind of pulled away at the end. But I expect much of the same. But I do expect both sides to find chances. The question is, can they put them away? You know, and I think that's where at least the Riverhounds have struggled in the postseason.
When we kind of take a step back and look at the history between these two teams, we know that the head-to-head record favors Pittsburgh. Right, they've gotten a few victories. RFC have only gotten one. There's been a draw or two there. So, if any, do you think there's a psychological edge that potentially lies with Pittsburgh, knowing that they've had mostly success against Rhode Island in the past?
From my standpoint, I would say they're confident. I think they believe, and they're playing at home. And I think this is a very good home team. They, you know, where they really struggled this year was, I think, all the way up until August. I think they just had that one road win, and I think it was at Rhode Island. That was their only road win all the way up until August this year. And then they kind of started to right the ship a little bit on the road. But at home, they've been very good. They haven't been great. They didn't beat Louisville or Charleston or, you know, North Carolina. But other than that, they were very good. They beat everybody else. They were very strong at home. So I think there is a certain level of confidence. I think that the Steel Army is going to be a factor. I don't know if one or both of you will be here in Pittsburgh on Saturday night. You'll see the atmosphere. It's a pretty good home and field advantage type field. But teams have come in here, and we've seen it in the playoffs. And I think everything I've seen from Rhode Island, especially in postseason, Connor Smith, this team has the mental fortitude to withstand to deal with you know, what the Steel Army and the Riverhounds and Pittsburgh will give them.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I've been watching the smack talk unfold between Defiant 1636 and Steel Army over this week, as it should, boiling into this very important match. Interestingly, Steel Army thinks they've already seen Defiance, and I can tell anyone that's listening from the Pittsburgh side, you have not yet seen Defiance in traveling, because no one has ever attempted to go down there. Maybe a smattering of fans, but you have not yet seen the full force of a LaBonda-backed Defiance 1636.
They haven't also, as far as I could tell, visited us. Maybe one or two fans. I remember
away game. From what I'm hearing, like these two groups are among the three best supporter groups in not only the Eastern Conference but at large. So it'll be interesting to see how these two bring their dynamic. I still have not yet heard a confirmation on whether LaBonda will be allowed to bring their seven drums into the stadium. I feel like Pittsburgh is going to deny that, even though most other stadiums have allowed it. So we will see. And then, of course, I can't wait to see if Shade gets thrown the Steel Army's way, that they're afraid of six additional drums. But having said that, Jason, back to what John just said about Kano and the system. You know, we talked about the psychological edge that Pittsburgh may have, but we also have to acknowledge that Rhode Island FC has found success in Highmark with that 1-0 victory in the Jägermeister Cup. We can't take that for granted, right? Like, that has to have massive ammunition in the bulletin board saying, hey, we've done what few teams were able to succeed at in Highmark this year, and we were able to put the boots the other direction. Head-to-head still speaks to it, like John said, but they have seen success at Highmark.
Yeah, and I think in that regards, they'll really have to go back and take some lessons from that and see what was successful in regards to that victory. Like, what lessons can they learn and bring that going forward? I think to a certain extent, you also kind of have to play with the form of how Rhode Island has been playing. Like, you don't want to change too much and like risk throwing it like a wrench in there. But if you can take a few tweaks without breaking the system to kind of emulate to a certain extent what happened back there earlier in the season at the Jägermeister Cup match, I think Connell will definitely be taking a look at what he can do there.
So, John, moving into Pittsburgh itself, you kind of mentioned this transformation over these last five matches, five unbeaten matches under interim or steward Rob Vincent.
Acting.
The official word
is acting, yes.
Acting. A legend himself amongst the Riverhounds. What exactly has – you kind of also just alluded a second ago that – and we've been saying this at length, that Bob Lilly is not just a head coach. He's a system. He's a set of American principles when it comes to soccer. How have you seen this team diverge from that or amplify what they already have done under Lilly in this very small sample size with Vincent so far, as they've made this run all the way to the Eastern Conference Final?
I feel like I laid that out pretty well in one of my, you know, previous responses. But just to kind of sum it up, it's a team that I think still plays by a lot of those principles, or built. A lot of these players are obviously, you know, handpicked by Bob, you know, in terms of most of these guys come in open, you know, they don't sign too many players just straight out. Like, I'm sure they signed, you know, Augie Williams or, you know, a couple other players, but they bring a lot of guys in through the open tryout process. They bring them. I mean, there's the college guys that, you know, Bob is very particular about, you know, his roster selection. So I think this is definitely a team that, you know, has his fingerprints all over it. And just the, you know, what, two games left in the regular season, three games, I'm sorry, left in the regular season for him, you know, when he steps away, when he walks, when he's, you know, put in administrative leave, this is still very much, Bob Vincent even admitted it, like, look, we're gonna stay the course. We are going to, you know, business as usual. And I think the coaching staff didn't want to change too much. And they've pretty much been the same, you know, in terms of formation. You're going to see a lot of this, you know, the 3-4-3 or defensively shaped five, you know, like a 5-3, you know, something like that, like five in the back and then the three midfielders. I'm sorry, two and then have the two attacking mids alongside Augie Williams. So it looks more like a 3-4-3, like when they're getting forward. Those two wingbacks are definitely making their way forward. I think that's the biggest difference, is that I think, as I said earlier, that you know, under Vincent, I think they're more willing to get forward and really trust that back three. I think that's the biggest thing. The back three with, you know, all USL selections, Sean Suber in the middle there, they're really trusting that. But they're even letting, you know, Beto Jedrić to get forward into the final third sometimes as well. He's a center back. Last week in the last 30 minutes in extra time, like I said, they only subbed two people. So Jackson Walty came in for Perrin Barnes, and he's one of the central midfielder pairing. Danny Griffin went back to the back three. Like in a major playoff game with everything on the line, Danny Griffin is back there with Sean Suber and Factor. So, I mean, I'm sorry, Suber and Jedrić. So, you know, they're tactically flexible in some cases. But I don't know if they can get away with that for too long, but that was something that they did. I think what that says is that Vincent's willing to send players forward. He's willing to send guys forward. They're going to keep trying to come forward. They just got to find those solutions in terms of finishing and creating more. They did take more shots from distance, which was one of Vincent's fortes as a player. He was unbelievable from outside the box and can nail it from anywhere. I don't know if this group, there's too many players out on this group that, you know, I think I'm sure a few of them can knock it in from far, but the way teams have been defending, they played, you know, Hartford and Detroit weren't giving them much room. I don't know. They're saying they're taking what the opposition is giving to them, but that's just the million-dollar question. They could have a big breakthrough night and have a couple big goals. They're very capable the way that they've been playing to break through.
Yeah, and we've seen them demonstrate that against Rhode Island FC. I think back to we talked with Danny Rivera, a former Pittsburgh Riverhound, and he would often describe Lily as someone who it was all about buildup. It was always like, you know, I'm glad that you ran up the field, but where was your next overlap? You need to wait for that to happen as a part of that system. It wasn't the freedom necessarily. I don't know if that's true, but that was Rivera's words of like, it's very much execute the Lily plan. And so seeing or hearing that Vincent maybe is willing to step a little bit outside the coloring lines and say, hey, if you got a shot from outside, take it. I think that could be a breath of fresh air that Rhode Island FC hasn't quite yet seen, in this Vincent version. I guess the only other thing is there an update? Have you heard anything that you're allowed to share about Bob Lilly? I think back to, you know, it's just terrible timing to announce this right as you're about to start this playoff run. You know, obviously it hasn't fazed the Riverhounds because they continue to win without him in front. Is there any update? Is there anything that's going on? Has the team kind of galvanized around a message about it heading into these potential final two games?
Yeah, I would say everything's been really tight, you know, as far as any information getting out or the exact reason for administrative leave. I've gone on numerous, you know, interviews and different podcasts and things like that, and I said the same thing. I would be unfair to speculate. There's obviously some things that, you know, we know, you know, in terms of personality or, you know, dynamics between players and coaches. But these are all things that, you know, at the end of the day, it's all pure speculation. So we don't know the exact reason for the club putting Bob on administrative leave. That being said, I think you had said that about galvanized. I think the team is galvanized regardless. I think they, you know, it was a week before that happened or a week or two before was the win at Hartford. The team kind of came together again, rallied around Danny Griffin. You know, we don't know what was said between him and Marlon Hairston, but and what happened. But the team was galvanized, I think, a bit then in terms of team unity. I asked Danny Griffin that question today, and you know, I could just, you know, body language sometimes tells me a lot, and I can see it. And they certainly, I think there's team unity. This group is tight. I see them, you know, after practices. I see them in the parking lot after games. They're a pretty tight-knit group, and I think that this is something that whatever circumstance was, whether they were too pretty involved in it or it wasn't a lot beyond their control. Either way, I think they're a tight-knit group, and they will fight for each other. And I think I think that's why what makes this matchup so great, because I think, you know, Rhode Island seems to have that as well. And by all indications, nothing. We don't have any news to share, but I think the team itself has used it to its advantage, if you will. And I do think, and Augie Williams said this last week, he does appreciate playing under Vincent, and he's had a little bit more freedom now. Has he been able to capitalize on it completely? Not quite, Augie, but maybe he will this weekend.
So, Jason, before we move into the ref assignments, I'm going to ask a silly question, but I heard it on the USL show with Kaler, and it was ridiculous, and I think he did it to be sensational. He can always debate us on it later, but he asked, if the Riverhounds win the whole thing now, is it the Riverhounds team and Vincent's win, or does Bob Lilly still get to share in that, regardless of whether he returns from administrative leave or we've already seen his last game as a Riverhound? I don't want to ask John that, because I know what John will say. So I'm going to ask an unbiased person who has no skin in the game.
I think he'll, to a certain extent, have like his hand in the trophy in that regards. The fact that he wasn't able to lead the team to it, though, would kind of maybe put an asterisk by it, because you would, you know, if would it have happened if he was in charge?
John is shooting laser beams through the screen right now. John, I know you want to answer. What do you got?
Well, I mean, you know, we've coined a phrase, Lily Ball, for a reason. You know, winning 1-0, winning probably games like the way they've been winning the last few weeks. Like I said earlier, the blueprints there. His fingerprints are all over it. Danny Griffin is, you know, has said that he's the captain of the team. He's definitely, even after, you know, Bob's his coach, and he's very, you know, it's just, for whatever it's worth. But, I watched this Riverhounds franchise before Bob Lilly came, and have been around it for 8+ years since he's been here, or 8 years now since he's been here. And it's not a conversation for me. I mean, any success that they have this year, he is still highly responsible for. Now, yes, was he there to get them to this finish line and get them through this? And maybe, you know, Robbie Vincent was, you know, a great avatar for someone who to get this team to you know, his personality, his calm demeanor, and his professionalism, and all those type of things that make up Robbie Vincent, I think are probably kind of the person you want guiding a team that's going through this right now. So I think, it is what it is. But I'll just say, you know, I think that Bob definitely deserves the credit for this franchise, for being there every single year, for getting in the playoffs, for never having a losing season, never missing the playoffs. Like, it's just every single year in his coaching career, he's never had a losing season or missed playoffs. I mean,
it is wild to me that Lily Ball has made the playoffs all 8 years, and yet this is their first Eastern Conference final appearance, whereas Cano Ball has had Eastern Conference final in all of its appearances. So it is such a fun story. Jason, walk us through the ref assignments for this match.
Yeah, the head ref here is going to be Nabil Ben Salah, with assistant referees Tom Felice and Bennett Savage, with a fourth official of Jeremy Shear.
Yeah, Nabil oversaw the sack game earlier this year that kind of kickstarted Sacramento's trajectory after we lost 2-0 at Centerville Bank Stadium.
Don't think we can have any complaints there. I think that was just Sacramento just smashing us.
Yeah, that was a bad day for Rhode Island. But he also oversaw Rhode Island's first ever home victory last year at Burns Stadium against El Paso. The only thing that I could find in kind of looking through his stats is Rhode Island FC is going to be going to think twice about the physicality approach in their game plan. He averages the highest amount of cards distributed across any ref that has seen at least 10 matches in the championship this season at 6.5. He's the most likely to go to the pocket. And, you know, I'll be curious how that impacts a physical team like Rhode Island. I mean, to Pittsburgh's credit, too, a very physical team. These are going to be defensive masterclasses. So I'll be interested to see. I mean, I don't know if you heard. Did you see how the Tulsa and Phoenix Rising game had 56 or 58 fouls? So basically, yeah, even with extra time, there was a foul or stoppage in play every 2 minutes of that match. Like, you're watching gridiron football at that point. That is not how soccer should be played. So hopefully we'll see sparks fly in all the right ways, and we have a pretty good match in front of us. John, I want to throw out the injury report. I'm not sure how accurate this is going to be for Pittsburgh, but for Rhode Island FC, as of media day, the only two players we know that will be out are Rio Hopgood and Joe Brito. Grant Stoneman, we saw return to that lineup in North Carolina. We'll talk about his start or lack thereof here in a second. I saw that Vactor was not in this 18 in last week's match. Is he questionable for this game, John, or do we expect to see him return?
Yeah, the latest word is that they've kept him kind of off on the sidelines last week, and then this week, this week Vincent said he kept a couple players that haven't really trained that much or trained that hard this week, but I think most of it was just precautionary. At this point in the season, you're not training that hard and every day in training anyway. As far as Vactor goes, he's still questionable. He took a pretty good knock there at the end of the Hartford game regulation, and he had come out. Just as you said, he wasn't in the 18 last week, and they kind of had this makeshift situation where they moved Luke Biasi into the center back line. That's pretty much it, though, as far as everything that I saw at practice today and everything that I'm being, privy to is that it's pretty much just Vactor who's still questionable. They would love to have him if he's able to go.
Yeah. I mean, it also doesn't help. I mean, you mentioned you're in the tail end of the season. Practices are probably going to light, but it also doesn't help that, the Riverhounds have had 240 minutes of play in the last 2 weeks, right? So having to have both of their games go first to extra time and then to penalties. Want to start things off with the Rhode Island FC prediction guaranteed to be wrong here. Jason, take it away.
Yeah. We've got Koke Vegas in net, Frank Nodarse, Karifa Yao, and Amini Diop in that back three. Amos Shapiro-Thompson, Clay Holstead, Ugo Bacharach, and Jojea Quisera in a midfield four there. With Noah Fusson, JJ Williams, and Zach Haravo making out that front three.
Yeah, and you could argue Haravo, Bacharach, and Holstead kind of interchange. Looking at the heat map from last week, kind of almost played in a 4-5-1 at times as they would swing in to absorb North Carolina. But in relation to Charleston, Haravo was the forward pivot for a majority of the midfield congestion, if you will, in this match against North Carolina. Holstead now taking the reins. So again, there's that flexibility. I think because of the Riverhounds, you're going to see Bacharach stay tucked tighter. And then it's really who's the more defensive need. We've seen Clay be capable of taking some shots, but Haravo has also done the same thing. So I think this is our core three. But Jason, Quisera gets the start over Aldair. Did he not do enough last week? Or is it just that Quisera is that much better on the left wing?
I just think that we'll get the change up there with Quisera. I don't think Aldair had a bad game in any way, shape, or form. But I think Jorge maybe offers a little bit of extra trickery there, maybe in terms of trying to get past someone, maybe a little bit of extra speed to hopefully go for it. And then I imagine from there, coach will be prepared to make changes if necessary.
Chico, people were asking online, should he get a start now after the performance? And I mean, John, I know that's got to be weird to see us have Chico as a weapon off the bench, but two goals do not, when you look at the regular season performance, they don't necessarily create the resume that he should start. However, I would argue Chico was a master of harassment in all of his outings against the Riverhounds this year. Should he get the start simply to give the Riverhounds a hard time? Or do you keep a player like that, especially with the way Kano has kind of perfected his system over this last six or seven matches? Do you keep things exactly the way they are and look to him as a weapon off the bench late into the game?
Yeah, it's a question. Do you feel like that that Rhode Island needs to be a little bit more, to have a little bit more somebody that's going to pull, draw defenders a little bit more? And is Williams doing that? Is your front attacking group creating enough trouble to stretch out? Because the key with the Riverhounds is catch them off guard. You may have to catch them on the counter. I saw a few potential cracks in there, at the end of in a little bit bit and pieces against Hartford, and then last week again right when Smith came in for Detroit. But the Hounds defended it well. I thought they did a pretty good job of kind of containing Smith. It just depends. I think that, but here's the thing, as if the Riverhounds only trusted two guys to come off the bench in last week, I think that that'll be interesting to see how Rob's squad rotation is. But I think depth in terms of coming off the bench late in matches, it's going to favor Rhode Island unless I don't know. I just think that right now, I mean, Bertrand Jacquesson is going to come, it can be a potential difference maker, for the Hounds. But I don't know. I don't see the Hounds, in terms of their bench. I mean, Jackson Walty is a solid defensive midfielder. They may have to use Osamanu off the bench as a defender, depending if Luke Biasi gets himself into yellow cards trouble, which he's been known to do, or, one of the backline guys is carrying a yellow or something along those lines. That would be my concerns for the Riverhounds are center back depth, because it's Danny Griffin ending up matched along the center back line. So these are type of things where if you've got Albert Dico on the field as a slate sub, you're taking advantage of the Hounds, kind of makeshift situation in terms of their rotation. But they do have guys that, could step in that haven't played as much the past few weeks. But we'll see.
So speaking of the Riverhounds, we've got basically a carryover of last week's game with Vogter still out. You let us know if anything's wrong here, but we have Eric Dick in net, that back three of Beto Yedrick, Sean Suber, and Luke Biasi out in for Vogter. And then in that midfield four on the wing, Perrin Barnes, Bradley Sample, Daniel Griffin, and Junior Itu. And then in the front, I've got Charles All, because I was surprised to see him up there. But Charles All, Augie William, and Robbie Mertz, just kind of in that, that two midfielder that kind of wings out with Williams up front. Historically, we've seen Jackson Walty and Burton Jacquesson be a starters against us in just about every single match they've been able to play. Jacquesson famously got his first goal. He opened his account against us in 2024. Interesting to see them both get downgraded. What is it about them? Is it because Vincent needs weapons off the bench, like you were kind of alluding to a second ago?
No, simply Jakusin's this year hasn't been in form, really, for the most part. He struggled quite a bit. He started the season off with an injury. He just hasn't really cracked the starting lineup all that much. Now, you saw him he was in the Jägermeister Cup. He started all those matches, because he was trying to get back into form. That type of thing. No, Augie Williams has been the go-to target forward. They tried to partner him with Jakusin a few times at the top of the attack, but Jakusin is just, he's been relegated pretty much to coming off the bench, especially the latter part of the season. Walty was just a matter of, Walty got hurt. He was having a great season, but he got hurt in August, and Bradley Sample has been excellent. And so, especially last week, I thought Sample might have been even one of the best players on the field last week. I don't think there's any loss. In fact, Sample's probably a little bit more creative doing things getting forward, where Walty is more of a stopper in that central midfield role. But and Charles All, you mentioned Charles All. I think that's a player who about three or four matches early in during the stretch, he's either scored goals or was right on, doing something early in a match that you know, kind of set the tone. So he's a good foil for the other side of Robbie Mertz. Robbie Mertz, chance creator. I think all is, it will extend possessions. He'll keep the ball at his feet and he'll do some good things. But he needs more touches to do that too. So sometimes he gets lost. And sometimes when he's on the ball and he's doing good things can happen, especially early, like I said, early in a match. He scored goals, I think, 3 times this year within the first 10 minutes of a match. It's an interesting thing to keep an eye on. And then, of course, Augie Williams, you know, just being better and more clinical, but also maybe coming back on the ball and redistribute a little bit more instead of just trying to get behind defenders. It will be interesting to see, because with Rhode Island and how well they defend, if there'll be some new wrinkles in the Riverhounds attack and how they use Augie Williams.
So let's talk about the defense. Pittsburgh currently riding on an unbeaten streak of 5 matches under Vincent. More interestingly, one of the lines I saw out of Nicholas Murray this week is that they're on their 4th current longest shutout streak at 422 minutes in all of club history. How does all of this matter? You combine that with, you know, again, the minutes played. Pittsburgh has the most tired legs if you look at total play time. How does this all come together to ensure that this defense and this ability to maintain shutouts continues here in this Eastern Conference final for Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I mean, again, they got to stick to their principles. They'll like I said, the 2 center defensive back midfielders with the 3 center backs. What you'll under a Bob Lilly system, that one of those wing backs has always tucked in, you know, pretty well. So then you would pretty much looking at 4 men across the back, and then maybe the other wing backs getting forward a little bit more. But yeah, I think that you'll just see them not really, they'll play a higher line, you know, at times. And I think under Vincent too, you'll notice that they're definitely playing a higher line, and they're trying to start possessions a little bit higher up in the field. And they're not playing as direct as they did under Bob Lilly. I think that's a couple things. But that plays into the confidence that they have defensively as well. I think they're very confident in that back three and in Dick in goal. And I think that, and the other thing is the factor, Highmark Stadium dimensions is not as, it's a little bit tighter than some other fields in the USL Championship. So that's something that the Hounds try to use to their advantage, and they want to keep the field. They want to keep the field tilted in the direction. They want the ball to be on their attacking third as much as possible. And even if that means the other team has a little bit more possession out of the back, but they're constantly pressing, especially at home, they're going to bring the high press. And again, these are all Bob Lilly principles that we'll see. So I think that's kind of how the Hounds want to play it. But we'll see how it plays out.
Jason, we've seen the high press not succeed against Rhode Island FC. If anything, they're very good about playing it out the back, very well controlled. Historically, where we've seen them flounder has been balls over the top and Route 1 over these last 10 games, which is something that Dick and company can do. Like, if they need to go throw something higher up the pitch, reset the line, and then win a second ball, like we've seen Riverhounds see success specifically against Rhode Island. How is Conoball set up defensively to match or mirror what we're going to see out of this defensive side? And I mean, just between you and I and John here in the room, is this going to be a 0-0 to extra time to pens? Because I mean, it's two defenses that are very good. And like, to both teams' credits, they got here through some 0-0 squeaky bum time.
It feels like it could go that way. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. Like you said, RFC aren't always the best at kind of defending those long balls. So I wonder if in a way we might see a slightly more reserved squad. And I mean, like you said, this team is a second half team. So maybe in that way, we'll kind of really play out the game. The first half, really kind of feel it out, see how it's going before we kind of really kind of hit full heavy metal and really go for it in that second half, to really make sure that we don't give up any early opportunities and really set ourselves up for failure and try and chase a game against a really stubborn defensive team who would honestly really not make it easy for us to really get back into it in that regards.
I agree with you. I think that I think back too to the physicality of, you know, what we saw in those earlier samples this year, JJ Williams famously gets a red card from judo chopping someone in the neck right in front of the Pittsburgh bench. You know, you can't do that, JJ. We've had a lot of instances of red cards where, like, you just know you can't do that. And we've seen the physicality. We've seen the aggression as these teams line up against each other. Again, I'd be curious to see how this lines up with the ref as we talk about it. I think to the point then, you know, one, would it be, is it okay from your perspective, Jason, that if Pittsburgh somehow does win, is it okay? And it was on a nil-nil that went to pens. Is it even appropriate that they make it to the USL Cup final having not scored a single goal in regular or extra time? Because I feel like that should be against the laws of USL and they just give us the advance.
I mean, in like the most USL way, you know, if RAFC don't make it and somehow we have Pittsburgh to a final without scoring a goal, I mean, just for the jokes, for the memes, you'd almost want them to win an entire championship without scoring a goal, right?
It reminds me of the Toronto Seattle back-to-back-to-back MLS Cups where they couldn't score against each other and it was three rounds of penalties. Each game was a round of penalties, and that's how it was decided as the cup champion. John, are you going to be able to sleep at night okay if your team wins the entire thing having failed to score a goal in any of the playoffs?
Well, of course, you know, as a reporter, you always root for the story first, and that's definitely a fascinating story, to say the least. So I'll just leave it at that. But no, I mean, as someone who loves the game, you don't want to see that. You want to see some goals scored, of course. But that should be a lot of. I don't know. I just think it's unfortunate because this is definitely going to be another slugfest. It could come down to one play, you know, in regulation or in extra time. And, you know, maybe finally one of these two teams gives, but maybe not. But, yeah, I think chances, I mean, if I'm a betting man, you know, you're going to go, you figured with these two, going to pens is pretty likely. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I think these two teams are not going to give much of an inch. And it just depends, you know, but we'll see. But yeah, I don't see it. I did do a little bit of research. And I was going to put in a notebook tomorrow that, you know, I did the USL championship and I think the least, this is, here's the sweet irony, the least amount of goals scored for a champion is five. And that was none other than Bob Lilly's Rochester Rhinos in 2015.
I love Rhino history. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right.
That team was incredible. They didn't give up goals that season at all. I think it was like 13 goals the entire season.
All right. Then let's go through these really quick because we're running out of time. I want to ask this question, Jason. We'll start with you. If RIFC have demonstrated that they have an ability to score very late. We talked about the impact in the North Carolina game. I didn't realize they've now scored 9 of their goals this season in the final 15 minutes, only conceding one. Is this something where they just need to kind of rope-a-dope and hold on? And as long as Pittsburgh can't find out before that, this is something Rhode Island FC can put to bed? Or is there something else that they need to be paying attention to up until the first goal is conceded?
No.
On either side.
No, I think that success can be a blueprint to go forward. We've seen that this is a very strong, stubborn defensive team, and Pittsburgh likewise. So if they can kind of really get through to that 75th minute, maybe that's when you bring on someone like a Chico, bring a Maxi Rodriguez, someone to kind of potentially break down a tired defense and maybe kind of find some cracks in that armor, if you will, and get a sucker punch late on there where there's not much time for the other team to really respond and force them to chase it, sets you up in a great position to move forward.
John, on the other side for Pittsburgh, I don't know, where do most of their goals come in terms of time frames? Are they a first half team this year? Are they a second half? And how will that impact how Rhode Island wants to play?
Goals? I can't remember the last time they scored. I'm sorry.
You have to have scored more than us this season. No, I'm going to look it up because we were anemic at times.
Well, I will say this: late in the season, they were getting ahead in matches. They were getting a 1-0 lead, and the problem they were having was they could never get over the hump and get a 2-0 lead. And then they finally did it against Indy 11, and then they did it the next week against Monterey Bay. Both matches with Rob Vincent coaching, so that was a huge thing. And you know, yes, it was all early first half goals. I mentioned Charles Aul getting goalie goals in matches. That happened at Hartford as well. If they could get that early goal, I mean, with the way that they've been playing defensively, and like I said, last week in the first minute of the match, Bradley Sample, I mean, there was a tremendous save by Detroit's keeper there the whole match, the whole makeup of the match was having a great game. Yeah, and you know, he had a great save, and Bradley, I think he it was like right on the first minute of the match, he was right on the edge of the box, and he sent a low ball towards inside. It was inside the left post, and it was a diving save. So that, you know, the Hounds have this tendency to try to strike early quickly in games. I think that some of it is strategic. They're trying to get one in real quick, and then I think that is, if anything, they've scored more goals early in matches. I don't have the exact breakdown, but then again, credit it late in the Hartford game on the road. That was such a physical, tough, hard-fought battle. It was 1-1 late, and the Hounds did pull out and get a late goal. So now I think we'll see, but they've been in the last part of the season scoring goals early in matches.
Yeah, and for the record, Pittsburgh has only scored 3 additional goals above our own 29. So these teams similar, but not at the same time. All right, gentlemen, 30 seconds or less. You're now the head coach for this match going into the weekend. What is one tactical tweak you would make to your respective teams? Jason, I'll start with you.
I think that what we saw success for against Pittsburgh was to a certain extent playing their game and kind of, but also at the same, like harassing them and slowing the game down. And if this is a more attacking version, I would try and maybe see if we can frustrate them to see if we can maybe really get under their skin and potentially maybe draw some extra fouls, get some cards, really, because we're going to defend too. So
Chico starting is what I'm hearing is the tactical adjustment. John, same question, 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think just being more active in the box, to me, that means draw a foul, you know, do something a little bit more in the box. I think they were a little too resistant to get into the box and do some damage against Detroit last week. I know Detroit defended really well. I know Rhode Island will do the same. But if you look at the last Rhode Island match, I think the Hounds did some good things when they took a few extra touches and at least tried to create something and get more touches in the opposition's box. I think that's, to me, I'm looking at that. I'm saying, come on, guys, let's get deeper and let's see what we can do here.
Okay. So similar to that question now, how does each of our teams win this match? Jason, we're going to start with, we're going to do a Rhode Island Pittsburgh sandwich here. So Jason, how does Rhode Island FC get the victory at Highmark?
I think they're going to really have to suffer there and really defend for their lives. And then, you know, do what they do best. I think they're going to have to find a late goal. I think that the longer this game would go on, the favor would go into Pittsburgh. I think if we see another 120 minute game, I know it would probably tire out the Pittsburgh, but it almost feels like that's what they were built for under Lily Ball, that they're comfortable there. I think RIFC need to win it in regular time.
John, how does this Rob Vincent side do the damage and move on to something they've never seen before?
I think getting out early. I think getting a good start and just capitalizing on something early. I think they score early in the first 10, 15, 20 minutes. I think they'll be in pretty good shape. Now, the flip side of that is if we get into one of these, you know, again, goes late and that sort of thing, I do think they've shown a tendency to get through those and now to get the pens, or even look strong late, because they did look strong late. I mean, again, Robbie Mertz was absolutely robbed in about the 115th minute last week. So I, you know, it's just taking chance. You don't want to take those chances. I think they want to be aggressive early, and you will see that. I think you will see that they will be very aggressive early. I think they want to get out on top, and they're going to take some chances. I think they might take some chances early, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think you're right that I think if Pittsburgh can get ahead with the go-ahead goal, like, it's going to be a problem for Rhode Island FC. We haven't seen a lot of instances this year where they've been able to claw back and break down a team, especially a defensive team, once they have the go-ahead goal. So I think either one of these teams, if they want to win, they have to figure out how to score first. But I think, to Jason's point, Rhode Island FC, while they're capable of scoring in the first half, not always, they're going to want to try to make sure that they do everything they can to play brave, but also not expose themselves. I think I said it earlier, the transition is where they can take advantage and then simultaneously watch for the long ball. They got to win the second balls in the middle. We talked, I think, all of us all night about the defense, but I think really we also haven't seen the best offensive production. So I think what that really means is the battle will be in that midfield. Who wins the second balls, who sets the tempo, and who moves the attack forward to give their respective team the chance. I think these are very similar storylines for both of these teams, and we're just going to have to see, does Kano Ball finally, well, I mean, they've done it before, but does Kano Ball get the day against Lily Ball, or will we see something that we've already seen before? I have full faith Rhode Island FC can get this done. They have the deeper bench, which I think is the key story here. And especially the fact that Vincent didn't go to his bench, like you mentioned, John, I think that there's more weapons, more versatility for Rhode Island if they need to suddenly flip this game on its head and just do something completely unheard of or unexpected. While credit to Pittsburgh for doing a lot with the player rotation they had last week, I just think the bench is a little bit deeper with this RAFC side. The fans, 51% out of almost 400 people voted, 51% believe Pittsburgh's going to pull off the win, 44% Rhode Island FC's direction, 5% of the sickos want the nil-nil draw and depends. So more power to you. Quickly, score predictions. Jason, we'll start with you. What do you got?
1-0 RFC.
Okay. John, what do you got?
I hate making predictions, but if I had to make one, I would say 1-1. I think both teams are going to get a goal, and then it's going to go to pens.
You know, I think I could stomach at least a 1-1 to give the people something in the regular time, and then let it, like, nothing's worse than nil-nil, and then it comes to pens. Reward everyone, both the away fans and the home fans. I like that. My heart is afraid of a nil-nil. It's saying just do what's right and do the nil-nil and depends. But I want to see a 1-0 for Rhode Island FC. We've done it once before. Why can't we again? But either way, I want one of these teams to win the whole dang thing afterwards. So it's been so much fun to do this tonight. As a quick FYI for watch party information for those of the Road Warriors that are traveling to Pittsburgh and instead are going to be watching the game from someplace at home, remember, the Road Warriors, this might be a rainy game. Look, it's projecting rain at this point. Weather, I don't know how Pittsburgh weather is consistently, but it's looking like rain, John. Okay. But for those that are
forecast up here, and then I put it away. Sorry,
it's okay. We'll plan accordingly, right? If you are watching the game, whether it be at the Guild or at Centerville Bank Stadium, remember, it's going to be a cold night here in Rhode Island. You can also check out watch parties at Moniker Brewing, High Motor Grill. And just remember, wherever you go, get there early, because it is going to be, Rhode Island is going to be activated for soccer on that Saturday kickoff at 6:30. You can watch this game in the New England area on ESPN Plus and Nesson Plus. John, is there any local broadcast that people need to plug as far as local?
In Pittsburgh, it'll be on Sportsnet Pittsburgh, which is like the local, like the Nesson in New England. Yeah, so it'll be on Sportsnet Pittsburgh, of course, the ESPN ESPN Plus.
Yep, and then we've heard rumors that Tom Quinlan, the RAFC play-by-play caller, has secured sponsorship money to broadcast the game over WPRO 790 and 99.7 FM. I don't know if that's going to be the case, so if you want to hear Tom's voice, make sure you just check it out at the time, but I just don't know yet if he actually pulled that off. So, hey, listen, John, it has been amazing getting to talk to you about Pittsburgh, about Rhode Island, about Eastern Conference Finals. What's going on in your life? Where can all the good people follow you and all of your incredible work?
Pittsburgh Soccer Now, of course. Just look us up. We've got it all covered, Western Pennsylvania soccer, everything from Riverhounds all the way down to the youth levels and everything in between. Of course, I do also have two podcasts, one Sounding Off on Soccer, which is focused mostly on anything above the youth level. And then I have a youth soccer podcast. It's called Kids on the Pitch, which is, we have a lot of fun with that as well. And I'm just real quick, the weather forecast is, it's a little going to be a little mild. So even if it does rain, it's not going to be too bad. I think it's going to be mild on Saturday. Just want to throw that in there.
Perfect. There, awesome. Well, hey, it's been great talking soccer with you, John. Thank you so much. It's been great having you on. In the meantime, make sure to check out all of our friends over at the Blazing Musket for all of your New England soccer coverage. And that includes RFC at theblazingmusket.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Threads, TikTok, and Blue Sky at rafcpodcast.com. You can check us out on Instagram at Raising Anchor. And then we have a website, raisinganchorpodcast.com. Anchors up, y'all. See you in Pittsburgh for those of you here traveling.
Anchors up. We'll see you guys soon.